Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. A lot of us are watching. The world is watching Iran right now. A lot of protests. Would you call it turmoil? Yes, we would call it turmoil there and chaos. What's going to happen? I mean, the U.S. is on the front lines of a lot of geopolitical battles, so to speak, in a lot of ways. There's nationwide protests in Iran. That's the Middle East, right? And threats across the Middle East. The regime there has responded violently. That's no surprise. As many as 10,000 arrests, some say 500 to possibly 2,000 killed, protesters killed in Iran. We gotta focus on that here today because it's not separate from what's going on in the Western Hemisphere, the U.S. seizing Venezuelan oil tankers. This is a campaign against sanctions, evasion, and also an authoritarian regime. Don't worry about it. University of Montana expert Miradad Kia breaks it all down today on Voices of Montana. Why don't I just welcome our guest and we'll get talking about what's going on in Iran and also, you know, wanted to pull in the sanctions and what's happening here in the Western Hemisphere and how this all may be related. And once again, it's a pleasure and honor, really, to welcome Dr. Miradad Kia. Professor Kia is a Middle East specialist and professor at the University of Montana. Decades of experience, and he is the director of the Central and Southeast Asia Studies Center. Good morning, Professor Kia. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Tom. I hope all is well with you. I use this opportunity to wish a delayed Happy New Year to all your listeners. I hope that it's a healthy, happy, and successful New Year. It's always a pleasure to be with you and respond to your questions.
Oh, thank you so much for that. And our listeners are saying the same to you, Professor. And thank you so much for the expertise here, because it's good to have a place to turn to try to put all these things into somewhat context that helps us understand. I'm going to start with, we need to talk about the Venezuelan and the Western Hemisphere sanctions.
Yes.
But of course, Iran has sort of exploded over the last few weeks. It started kind of in mid-December. I noted some are saying as many as 2,000 killed. That would not surprise me in that crackdown as well. 10,000 arrests, internet blackout. And you, of course, with a lot of experience and a lot of relations and relationships across the seas. You know, what are your thoughts? What's going through your mind?
So let me give you an update first about the number of casualties.
Thank you.
As of this morning, all international and even U.S. governmental institutions are actually increasing or raising the number of those who have died at 12,000.
Wow.
This is a total massacre, Tom, by a fascistic Islamist regime against its own unarmed and innocent people. The only crime the people of Iran, over 90 million people, have committed is they came to the streets and they asked for freedom, for basic freedoms that we take for granted in this country. The freedom to think, the freedom to express themselves, the freedom to have access to internet and other means of, you know, social media, basically, or other means of communication. And they want a democracy. They are sick and tired of this Islamic regime, which has basically held the country hostage since February of 1979, when the revolution overthrew a pro-U.S. Secular government, the government of the Shah. What I can tell you, and I can share with you with evidence, actually, is that it started with an economic protest by the business community, the so-called bazaar. You know, bazaars are the marketplaces, there are merchants, traders, shopkeepers, and so on and so forth. They started it. Why? Because the incredible devaluation of the Iranian currency. I think we have talked about it before, but the last time I left Iran, one U.S. dollar was equivalent to seven Iranian, you know, the official name of the currency is rial, but in fact it's toman, and that is how the Iranians refer to their currency, toman, which is T-O-M-A-N. It was $1 to 7 toman. Last week, it was $1 to 147,000 toman.
Wow.
That gives you a sense of what has happened. The Iranian currency is a worthless piece of paper, basically. They came to the streets. They protested. Very quickly, the protest turned into political demands, and first down with Khamenei, the supreme leader, and then down with the Islamic regime, and then followed by we do not want this fascist regime, we do not want an Islamic government, and then, of course, the most shocking, Javid Shah, which in Persian simply means long live the Shah, which is reference to the son of the late Shah of Iran, Prince Reza Pahlavi, who lives in this country outside Washington, D.C., and calling on him to return to Iran and assume the responsibility for transition to a new system of government. Now, right away, people say, oh, they want to return to 1979 or before the monarchy that was there. No, they do not want that. They want a transition to a national referendum. And the national referendum will ask people whether they would like to have a constitutional republic modeled after the United States or a constitutional monarchy modeled after United Kingdom or, you know, some of other European countries. That's what they want. They do not want the Islamic regime anymore. They are sick and tired of this, these religious edicts that has basically destroyed their lives, and massive inflation, massive unemployment. They want their economy to return. I remember that in 1979, Iran was ahead of South Korea in terms of gross national product.
Yeah.
Today, it's behind North Korea. This is where we have gone in that country. And people want to reverse to where they were and restore their dignity, their freedom, and create a government of the people for the people.
It takes so much courage for the people to get to this point, a lot of frustration, but courage to act in the way they're acting. And they're looking to the outside world to see what our response is going to be. I'm going to go back a little bit when the U.S. Invaded the Middle East, invaded Iraq, and established a kind of a pro-democracy government there. You know, we've talked about the domino theory, where it works. Does it work in reverse? The domino theory, if you have conflict in one area, it could easily spread to other areas.
Right.
I looked at that possibly working in reverse in terms of if you have freedom in some area, that concept of freedom could, you know, also spread to other areas. Are we seeing, because I believe there, you know, the people there believe that there's going to be some kind of global response here. Are we seeing that? Are we seeing the kind of the leftover of that activity years ago?
Yeah.
Or is it a lot have to do with, or in combination, all the communication that's now available around the world?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You're hitting the nail on the head. First and foremost, to respond to your great question, we have to remember that Iran is not an Arab country. People always confuse the Middle East as just Arabs and Israelis. Iran is not an Arab country. The official language is Persian. Iranians are not Arabs. For the last 3,000 years, they have not been Arabs. They have one of the most ancient historical cultural identity in that region. And in fact, until 1979, I can testify to you in person, because I went to school there for several years, my best classmates were from Israel. Why? Because Israelis and Iranians had a very good and close relationship. In sharp contrast to the Arab world, Iran never had any problems with the state of Israel. Israel was an ally. Iran was an ally of Israel. There were daily flights from Iran to Israel, from Tehran to Tel Aviv. I never forget this. A lot of Iranians would travel to Israel for emergency, advanced surgical procedures. This is how close the relationship was. And this government has tried to reverse it and make Iran resemble an Arab Islamic country. Iranians resent that, and they oppose it. The Iranian regime has also reversed the relationship that we had with the United States. As an Iranian-American, we are known to have had the closest relationship with the United States until 1979. There were tens of thousands of Americans living, working in Iran, and I knew a lot of them, and I was friends to several very good American friends who actually had their children in Iran because they got married there, their children were born. Whatever the case may be, this government has reversed that relationship with the United States to a close alliance with Putin and Xi Jinping in China. This is where the people of Iran have revolted. They want to return to a friendly relationship with the United States, with U.S.'s close allies. And what is very important in all of this is the fact that they do not want to be the pariah, their government to be the sole sponsor of terrorism in the region. And in exact reverse of what you mentioned in terms of Iraq, it is not us invading. It's the Iranian people asking, requesting from President Trump and his administration to intervene on their behalf and stop, at least minimize, the atrocities being committed against them, because these are unarmed, peaceful demonstrators. But I have to tell you this, and I have to emphasize, there is not a single Iranian I have talked to who wants boots on the ground, who wants U.S., special forces to land. Yeah. They have the capability to overthrow this regime. But they do want moral support. They do want technological support, because this government has shut down all technological connections, all network and internet connections with the rest of the world. And they want the United States, at least from the air, to intervene and basically paralyze the Iranian military capability to kill its own citizens. They do not want U.S. troops. They know it's going to be costly. They do not want American lives to face killing, murder, and terrorism on the ground in Iran. They know the enemy, and they know how to fight it. They just need our full support, and I hope and pray that President Trump, who actually issued just moments ago a very heartwarming message, will actually activate all possible options, short of military intervention inside Iran, to help them free themselves.
A lot of questions for us to ask as we look at what's happening in the Middle East. We'll also focus a bit here, too, on the Western Hemisphere and the shadow tanker and those seizures of Venezuelan tankers in our side of the world. But looking to Iran right now, because there's turmoil there, what tools do the U.S. have? And also, you think about the shift or the balance of power in the Middle East. There's a lot of other countries and people in other countries looking at this. So what are the risks for the U.S. military or the military involvement or diplomacy? What is going to be the primary path for a response, a global response, to what is happening in Iran? We are with, again, Professor Mehrdad Kia. Dr. Kia is a Middle Eastern specialist, professor at the University of Montana, and written extensively on Iran, Iraq, and the broader Middle East dynamics there. And always appreciate your expertise, Mehrdad. Going to start with just the options, and I'm not even going to try to lay a foundation for that. What are wise options? likely options, and then, you know, even to the dramatic options.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I think that before I answer again, great question. Let me also suggest, because you alluded to it, a lot of people say, well, there might be a war as a result of this. I always tell them, if you want peace, let's all come together and join our voices and get rid of this regime. Because peace will be restored, not completely, but overwhelmingly, if this regime goes out, is overthrown. Why? Ask yourself the following question. Who has been sponsoring Hamas? Who has been arming Hamas? Who has been funding it to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars? It's the Iranian regime. Who has been funding Hezbollah in Lebanon with all its long-range missiles targeting the state of Israel? It's the Iranian regime. Who has been funding and arming these poor people, Houthis, in Yemen to attack shipping in the Red Sea? The Iranian regime. It's the biggest sponsor of terrorism. If you want peace to be restored in that part of the world and for our own security, energy, shipping, all sorts of other issues, people on the ground, even the simple tourism of people from Western countries to go to that region, very ancient, and visit the magnificent city of Jerusalem without fear, for example, you have to get rid of these people. As long as they are there, they will be the cause of violence and mayhem. What are the options, as you mentioned? I think there is, at least in the very beginning, there will be an all-out cyber attack on Iran's cybersecurity structure. I'm getting a sense that this is under not only under review now, but we are moving in that direction very rapidly. That will shut down the Iranian government's infrastructure in terms of electricity, in terms of even water, in terms of providing any kind of service that it would try to, especially for its own supporters. The second option is to target the headquarters of repression, fear, and terror, which is basically the elite forces, the Revolutionary Guards. They were targeted, you know, by Israel several months ago when Israel made several strikes against Iran. They lost 20 of their generals, their commanders, but they still have an infrastructure. They have a force, I think, active. The official number is 400,000, but the active members are somewhere between 50 to 60,000. If there is a sustained attack on their headquarters, command, and control from the air, they will melt. They have no system to resist against an all-out air attack or attack from the air from the United States. And the third one, very important, is to restore internet connection for Iranian people. Why? Because Iranians rely on all kinds of social media outlets, internet. I'm in contact with Iran through internet and phone lines and cell phone lines, especially. They have to be restored so the people of Iran can find the courage again to come in millions. They came to streets in the last 3 weeks. In millions, literally, and we need to have them back on the streets and organizing their demonstrations. We, for the first time, have a leader in the face of, in the person of Prince Reza Pahlavi, the oldest son of the late Shah. I understand, and this is not as reliable as I would like it to be, but I understand that he will be in Florida today or tomorrow, and the place's name corresponds with the name of the place where President Trump is staying, Mar-a-Lago. So and he's giving a major speech to a Jewish group, to an American Jewish group. And there might be a meeting between President Trump and Prince Reza. I urge the White House, I urge the president, and I urge the entire administrative structure, especially Secretary Rubio, to recognize Prince Reza Pahlavi as the legitimate leader of Iran. And I do believe that if we cross that line, we will have a very, very important step. We have taken a very important step ahead of us, which is the complete overthrow.
Yeah, that's that is something that is doable, as they say, at this point, you know, diplomatically, too. And the Crown Prince, Pahlavi, had, and thank you for that. I watched a bit of that video, CBS News interview. One of the first things he said was he questioned, are we alone in this fight?
Yeah.
You know, talk about the magnitude of that question for the rest of the world.
Right. So he has surprised a lot of people because, Tom, everybody thought, well, he's sitting, you know, we have voices. I don't want to name names, but in mm-hmm. this case, I want to name names. Patrick Beth David, who is actually a Republican, a supporter of President Trump, going after Prince Reza Pahlavi. Oh, he's too Americanized. He has been sitting here. I think, you know, just on the personal side, Patrick Beth David is a little bit upset because he wrote a 19-page letter to Prince Reza Pahlavi, and Prince Reza Pahlavi thanked him but did not respond to him in a long response that Patrick would have liked to see. We have to set aside this childish behavior. Patrick Beth David, by the way, is a Christian Iranian who left Iran when he was very young. And I have to tell you this, and, you know, a lot of people have written him since he made that that statement, that no Christian community would have survived had it not been for the Shah of Iran guaranteeing their safety and security before the revolution. And that's the father of Prince Reza Pahlavi. Instead of expressing our thanks and gratitude and say, as long as you guys were there, we felt more protected. The Jewish community felt protected. The Christian community felt protected. Now let's go after his son and declare him basically not ready to assume power. I think we have a national symbol in Prince Reza Pahlavi. The best thing I have to tell you and your listeners is he does not want power. He does not want to become the king. He does not want to become his father or grandfather. He wants to be a transition leader to organize a national referendum for the Iranian people for the first time to come to ballot boxes and choose what kind of government, constitutional monarchy, constitutional republic, whatever they want, and he will abide by it.
The Iranian protest, the U.S. sanctions in our Western Hemisphere, we're talking about how those are related in this segment as we welcome back Professor Mehrdad Kia and you, too, from Montana, for Montana, Voices of Montana. Thank you for making us a part of your Montana Day once again, and thank you for being here for this one. Specifically, got a couple of questions we'll get to. Professor Mehrdad Kia, once again, from the Central and Southwest Asian Studies Centers at the University of Montana. UM's Distinguished Teacher of the Year in 97, Most Inspirational Teacher a couple of years later, and also named one of the U.S. Professors of the Year by the Carnegie Foundation. A lot of expertise, and boy, whenever you share it with us, Professor, we learn a whole ton more. So thank you for this, and I know it's a trying time as originally from Iran as well, and with family members there. So thank you for sharing some of that with us here during this. As you noted, not getting a lot of sleep. I can imagine that's the case.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. And it's really, I say this sincerely, it's really a privilege and honor to be with you, Tom, and also to speak to all your listeners, the good people of Montana.
Yeah, they've got hearts that are concerned about everybody including those wherever, even their enemies, so to speak. Yeah. I'm going to take a couple of calls from those Montanans, and I know we got to get to Venezuela because the tie is not not to be missed on all of this. But Nancy, listening in Roundup on our Billings KGHL. Good morning, Nancy. You're on the air here with someone you know well, Mirdad Kia.
I sure do. I just absolutely adore this man, and it's always an honor to speak with him and his wisdom. He is such a man of great wisdom of the Middle East, because, you know, the Middle East and the United States, we're so far apart in so many ways, and he's always the person who can bind us together, who teaches us our differences and how we can overcome them. And good morning, Dr. Mirdad Kia. I have a quick comment and then some questions here. I remember the downfall of the American embassy and the Shah in 1979. And, of course, all the Americans that worked in our embassy, they were blindfolded, and they were numbly, I can remember, stumbling down the steps of our embassy with these fanatic Iranians, you know, surrounding them and threatening them and everything else. And they were held in captivity for, my God, I think 3.5 years in horrible, horrible living conditions. Yeah. And, of course, at that sad time, we had Jimmy Carter as president. And he was, of course, a very weak president. He did nothing. He did bring the Shah and his family to the United States to save their lives. But I want to say something about the Shah. There was accusations and there was evidence that he committed a lot of crimes against humanity also. He imprisoned people and was torturing Iranians, so there is another side to that story. Right. Now, my questions are this, sir. Okay, we've lost our embassy. If we help overthrow Iran, will we get our embassy back? Because I believe that we should. And you more or less have answered my question. You're very optimistic that the Iranians will win this revolution. I know that there's, 9 million people that live in the country and 150 armed militants that are absolutely vicious. I'm praying to God that they do win, and you've given me some thoughts on that and some hopefulness. And the third question is the prince. He is the eldest son of the Shah.
Yes.
And do you think he is the answer for Iran? I mean, I still have some doubts. I hope it does work out. And thank you so much, sir. I will listen off air to your reply.
Thank you, Nancy.
Nancy, thank you very much for your excellent questions. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice and to respond to your excellent questions. You have brought a lot of interesting issues. We are short of time, but I will try to answer them as quickly as possible. On the question of the embassy, one of the promises made, and I'm absolutely certain that if the regime collapses, we will see this right away. We will reopen the United States Embassy in Tehran. The atrocious, illegal, and inhumane behavior of a group of thugs who seized that embassy against all diplomatic and international rules and laws, and held our diplomats hostage for 444 days during, as you said it correctly, a weak presidency of Jimmy Carter cannot be forgotten. And the relationship needs to be restored. The U.S. Embassy is still there and intact. And I hope and I pray for the day when we see the U.S. diplomats returning to Iran, but also U.S. citizens visiting Iran. Everybody, whoever who has gone to Iran, even during these tumultuous times, says they are the most pro-American people in the Middle East. They are. Remember, they are the most educated people in the Middle East next to Israel. They are the youngest population. 70-some percent of the population is below 30 years old. They're very young. They're very educated. And they want a good relationship. Not a normal relationship, a friendly relationship with the rest of the world, but especially the United States. As far as the Shah is concerned, you're absolutely correct. There were abuse of human rights. The number of political prisoners was about 2,000 to 3,000 people. There was torture. You are absolutely correct. But I have to tell you, there is always the shades of gray from white to black, and there was nothing in comparison to what these fascists have done. Mass murder, mass torture, rape, incarceration without any justification. The least you can say about the Shah's policies was that it was always open to human rights organizations, to U.S. observers to visit Iranian judicial system and the prison system. Right now you have no contact with the rest of the world, so they can do whatever they want. But as far as Prince Reza Pahlavi, he has spent almost 40-some years of his life in this country. I know him. He's a very, very enlightened and democratically minded person. He does not want to return to the authoritarian days of his father. And he wants to be a transition figure. He does not want to become the Shah of Iran, you know, and go to a palace and, you know, rule from there. So we have a person who is very democratically minded individual who basically adores and respects the United States as an ally, and he wants to restore that, a relationship with the rest of the world that is normal. And he will stop all forms of terrorism and violence, which is the biggest and the best news. Beyond that, I have to say myself, because I believe in a national election, a national referendum, and for my part, if I may actually venture to say this, I hope that it's not a monarchy, that it's a republic, it's a constitutional republic, and Iranian people can elect their president, their parliament, or their Congress, every 4 years by going to ballot boxes and vote for them. We are looking at Prince Reza Pahlavi as a transitional leader, not as leader permanently for life.
Professor Mirdad Kia with us here. We'll take one more quick call, and then I'm going to talk about Venezuela. We got to get to that topic here as well. Skip, go ahead. You're on the air here. Thanks for your call today for Professor Mirdad Kia.
And thank you, Tom. And I think it's wonderful that you can speak about Venezuela also. Dr. Kia, thank you for coming on. And this morning on another program, two or three of us were talking about you because you're going to be speaking at the Pachyderm meeting at Famous Dave's on Friday, yes, which we're all looking forward to. And, sir, when the son of the Shah would become a transitional leader, if this can happen, would he have to be elected in some way or installed? And would there be a team for him to do his duties with? And then, sir, if this all comes about and Iran becomes the way that you speak it could be, will you personally have the opportunity to finally go there and enjoy a wonderful visit in your own life? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Skip.
Skip, thank you very much. It's wonderful hearing your voice and listening to your questions. I want to tell you that Prince Reza Pahlavi has a very competent team surrounding him. That team is in daily contact with the Trump administration. I do not know if the Iranian people will win. The slaughter might just go on, and we will not have sufficient reaction. That would be a tragedy if we miss this golden opportunity. If we want a secure, peaceful Middle East, this is the biggest precondition, prerequisite to get rid of this regime, and the opportunity has now offered itself. As far as myself, you know, all I remember from Iran, I don't know how many people have looked at the images. People always think about the Middle East, vast desert, camels, oil, and so on and so on. Iran is actually a very mountainous country. The hobby of the majority of Iranians, especially those who live in Tehran during winter season, is skiing. People always said, no, they ski over there, yes. And it's not just for the rich or middle class. Skiing is very popular. because it gets a lot of snow and it becomes very cold. Iran is a beautiful country. Why? Because in the north you have the Caspian Sea, and in the south you have the Persian Gulf. It's between two bodies of water which are majestic. And the weather, it's just, especially in the south, is very Mediterranean. It's very moderately cold in the winter, but very beautiful during spring and summer. So do I want to go back? Of course. And of course, as you know very well, Iran is home to one of the most ancient civilizations. If that country opens up, it will immediately compete with Italy, Greece, and Turkey over whose heritage is more ancient, and especially with Greece and Italy, because Iranians go back to 3,000 years ago. The ruins, the remains of their ancient palaces and cities are still sitting there for the world to watch.
Did not save enough time here, Professor, for a full-on discussion here, but let's go to Caracas.
Yes.
The legality of those seizures and then the strategy behind them.
So thank you for bringing this up, Tom. First and foremost, I want listeners to know that Iran's closest ally in the Western Hemisphere was Maduro and Venezuelan government. Iran had spent $2.5 billion in arming Maduro's security and military forces. They both were involved also in narco-trafficking and in drug trafficking, of course, and the purpose was to basically ship as much as possible cheap drugs into the United States. These are not just accusations. These are facts which have been proven. And, of course, there were members of Iran's security and military operations or units in Caracas. A lot of these Iranian leaders who were afraid of Iranian people revolting, they had bought millions of dollars worth of property, apartments, real estate, homes in Caracas and in the surrounding region, in the surrounding suburbs. So this goes back a long time ago, and it started with Chavez and the hated Holocaust denier, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, who were buddies, who were very close. And, of course, the destruction of the collapse of Maduro regime and his detention was a huge blow to this terrorist network. By the way, the other person who was involved in this was Bashar al-Assad, the former dictator of Syria, whose family was in drug production and drug dealing, and they were shipping so much of their drugs to this country via Venezuela. In return, and I underline this, because U.S. authorities were wondering, we have shut down all links between the terrorist organization Hezbollah in Lebanon and the outside world, and yet Hezbollah was receiving $60 million in monthly contribution from some outside source. Upon in-depth analysis and investigation, U.S. authorities discovered that that $60 million was going from Iran to Venezuela and via Venezuela back to Lebanon. It was actually Venezuelan government which was supporting and arming a terrorist organization in Lebanon on behalf of Iran to reciprocate for all the aid and assistance that it was receiving from Tehran.
I have 1 minute, sir.
Yes. So I think it was a glorious operation. I completely support it. And I hope that we continue with this foreign policy of saying no to the dictators and standing up to them.
Yes. When you put it that way, that seems like a common sense sort of thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's more to discuss here. I know strategically China is quite involved here with buying the Venezuelan oil, and President Trump may have, a strategy behind this as well. We'll hit on that some other time. I know it's a very trying time for you, an exciting time as well. And so we're all hoping and praying for the best, Professor. And, and I hope we do make some wise steps as we go forward in this.
I hope so as well, and it's always a pleasure and honor to be with you, Tom.
We're lucky. We're lucky, sir. Thank you so much, and be well, and again, for your family, too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.